This recording, Jamaica History 1, is copyright the International Dialects of English Archive.
I was born in Stirling, in the parish of St. Anne, which is on the north coast of Jamaica. And I was born in 1940. I lived for the first 8 years of my life in the country, in Stirling, with my grandmother. I have two sisters who are younger than I am, and we all three lived with my grandmother. Our mother left us when I was eight to go to the United States of America, and we thought she had gone for a short time and would return, but she never did return. And when I was 15, I think, my mother and my father divorced. So my sisters and I, for all our lives were brought up by our dad. He moved my older sister, Faye, who is, I think, 2 years younger than me. He moved us to Kingston, where he worked, to live with him, and leaving my younger sister, who is 4 years younger than me, still with my grandmother. So Faye and I were brought up in Kingston from the age of eight. Every holiday, we returned to the country to be with my grandmother. Much of what I know about the world, how my character is formed, my attitudes to life and living come from my grandmother. My father was a very stern person, and I think because he had very poor upbringing himself, hardly went to school. He learned what he knew from his own education, if you like. He came from very poor stock, was determined that his children should be given the best possible education. My father was half Indian and half African. His people came from Assam after the plantations were left when when slavery was abolished. The plantations still needed to be tended, and that's when all the indentured people from different parts of the world were brought to the Caribbean, from China, from Asia, from England, from the Europe. And my father's people came from Assam in that movement. And his mother was a Maroon. She was one of the Maroons who escaped from the plantations to live in the Cockpit Mountains in Jamaica. So he was half African and half Indian. On my mother's side, there is a European intrusion. We never discovered what it is. We think it might be Scottish because I have a cousin who has red hair and fair skin, and I have my second sister, for example, is very fair skinned too. My sisters and I eventually went to Woolmer's Boys School for me, Woolmer's Girls School for them. My father paid for us, so he had to work extremely hard to do this. And from an early age, I think I have a memory of 6 years old speaking a poem at my infant school. And I think I date my desire to be a performer from that. So from the age of six, I was determined that I would be a performer. Through my senior school, I was taught by a wonderful expatriate Englishman called Tony Watson, who taught us English, but who also was in charge of our drama group. And from the age of 10, I was taking part in All-Ireland speech festivals, All-Ireland amateur dramatic festivals that were open to all the high schools, and winning prizes in these competitions from the age of 10. Tony Watson was an extraordinary role model, my very first, who had such a breadth of knowledge and such a breadth of reading and such a breadth of understanding of literature. And he would take bits of script, which he would translate from another culture or even another language, and would make plays for us to act. And also, too, he encouraged us to use our own patois. My father had an antipathy to patois. My father also had an antipathy to performance of any kind. My father was determined I should go nowhere near anything to do with the theatre. But Tony, I remember once we created a play based on Joseph and his amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, which is now what it is. Joseph and his Coat of Many Colours was what we devised. And it was, we did it entirely in patois, and it was called Joseph and Embroidering. Joseph and in Brethren. And that must have been when I was probably 15, maybe. We did that play. And my best friend, Jeffrey, played Potiphar's wife. And he was, and I played Joseph. And my friend Fairweather was much better than me. He took all the plaudits because he was so good as Potiphar's wife. I'll never forget that. By the time I was 18 and doing my, what we called higher school certificate then, equivalent to A-level, I was being taught by another wonderful, wonderful, wonderful teacher called Basil McFarlane, who taught us English. I took English at A-level. And that's where my love of all the romantic poets came from. My favorite poet was Keats when I was at school, and my second favorite poet was Wordsworth. I'm thinking back now to these competitions and thinking where my accent might have been then. Because in our childhood, I think we spoke fairly sort of ordinary Jamaican speech, not too heavily accented, but not patois. My father loathed the patois, I think I've said. But my sisters and I and my cousins, we were very close. I have my first cousins lived very close to us in the country. But we would get together and practice the patois. But it also would come out in our songs, our folk songs, so, or our games. Or, for example, this long time, girl, me never see you. Make me hold you, hun. Is a long time, girl, me never see you. Make me hold you, hun. Peel it, young crow, sit down, but read up a pick off me blossom. Make me hold you, hun, girl. Make me hold you, hun. And we would talk patois to each other. We would, like I've been saying before, you know, like maka joke me, you know. What you do there? Maka joke me. Or watch them woman them with basket pan them head. But except we would say bankra. Them woman bankra. But also to at that time in my childhood, to speak patois meant that you came from peasant stock. You worked the land. You were probably not terribly well educated, or you might have been educated only to elementary school level, and then you had to leave to go and work. So anybody who spoke patois immediately were branded as not being of the best. By the time I got to town, to Kingston, my father didn't want us mixing with common children. My father had this extraordinary kind of view of the world and himself. He thought he was better than he was. He came from peasant stock himself, but he had moved up into the middle classes and thought anything below that wasn't worth having. So we'd only speak patois secretly. So these poems, these festivals I'm talking about, we would have had a category of purely English poems. So could be European, but there was also a category for Caribbean and West Indian verse, or Caribbean and West Indian literature. And my memory of those poets like Constance Hollar, Roger Mace, Claude McKay, was that they wrote in perfect English. But perhaps when we spoke them with more of a little bit of a lilt. By the time I was well into those festival things, there was a category then called Jamaica dialect. And the poetry from the Jamaica dialect section was more often than not by Louise Bennett. I can't quote you any of Louise Bennett in case you get into copyright problems. But I think most of those poems I remember, because she wrote in dialect, most of those poems would have come from her. In my sixth form time, in my higher education time, I can remember very much with our Mr. McFarlane, our teacher, spending many, many lessons working with Keats, Shelley, Wordsworth. And I'm thinking now that perhaps something like Ode on a Grecian Urn or Ode to a Nightingale would have spoken that perfectly well. But perhaps my heart aches and a drowsy numbness pains my sense as though of hemlock I had drunk. Or emptied some dull opiate to the drains 1 minute past and Lethe words had sunk. 'Tis not through envy of thy happy lot, but being too happy in thy happiness, that thou, light-winged dryad of the trees, in some melodious plot of beechen green and shadows numberless, singest of summer in full-throated ease. I think perhaps we were closer to that than to a formal kind of English sound. So what we were learning in our high school, I think, was perfectly good English. Jamaican English, if you like, that would have been spoken by middle-class people. And by then, of course, Jamaica was developing a very upper middle class. By the time I was leaving school, there was no possibility of training for an actor, which is what I wanted to do. My father had an antipathy to it anyway. He would never allow it. My father always said he didn't want me to become one of those people. My father thought I would become gay and that he didn't want anything to do with any of that. I used to have to secretly steal out of the house at night, conniving with my sisters to get back in after he'd gone to bed. I went into the civil service when I left school. My father was determined I should become a professional person, but I had no feel for it. I got good grades in English and Spanish and history, but no science. And so I went into the civil service, and then after 6 months, I thought this is not for me, and I got a job teaching on the strength of my A-level results. I taught for 2 years. I taught history and Spanish, and I also took charge of the school I was working in, took charge of their drama group, of course. We used to call it elocution in those days. It's called the elocution festivals and the drama festivals. That was my only way of getting any kind of access to acting, was to run the drama group. After 2 years, my father said, so what are you going to do? What are you going to do? So because I would have just gone to college, become a teacher. There seemed something peculiar to me to have arrived at the age of 19 and to go to university to be with the same boys I had been with when I was in school all through my high school. And they, of course, were heading towards being politicians, towards being teachers themselves, to go into some kind of form of higher civil service. And I was not interested in any of those things at all. So my father said, because when I left school, my headmaster said, what are you going to do? He was English. And I said, well, I don't know. And said, you could always teach. So I thought, well, I could always teach. My father said, if I wanted to go to England, he would fund me. My father worked for the United Fruit Company, which meant that he had access to banana boats traveling from Kingston to England. And so he got me a berth on a banana boat. I went on a boat called the SS Sulaco. And we sailed, it took us 10 days. I arrived at Southampton. In the meantime, of course, what I had got, which my father didn't know, was a prospectus from the Rose Bruford College of Speech and Drama. In my luggage was this prospectus. At that time, as you know yourself, we had a dual course at the school, acting and teaching. I told my father I was interested to go and learn, go to a college to become a teacher. In 1961, when I arrived, there was no way I could pay to go to Rose Bruford College, and I had no means of going there otherwise. At that time, I thought my accent was probably much as it was when I went to Rose Bruford, but it was easing out gradually over the years. I worked for 4 years, qualified for a grant from my local council, which was Ealing, and I went to the Rose Bruford College. I had auditioned twice. The first time I auditioned, I got in but couldn't afford to go. And the second time I auditioned, I had my grant and I went. I got married in 1965 in August, just before school started in September. I was more than pleased when I arrived in the college, really, to be aware of the history of the college. Though it's fair to say that there was a policy then of taking one black student every year. You may not remember that, but in each year there was one black student. and it was me in 1965. But it was clear to us that if you didn't arrive at the RP sound, and pretty quickly by the end of your first year, there was a danger that our diploma, would be an overseas diploma, which means that you probably couldn't work in England, you couldn't teach. And so those of us who cared about such things, like me, determined to get rid of the accent. It surprised me that I had an accent, to be perfectly honest with you. But Malcolm Morrison had extra classes for people like me to get rid of the accent, and so I did. We went to those classes, I think Tom might have been one of them, and we got rid of our accent. I find it hard now, after all these years, to actually determine what that accent is. I can't remember it so clearly. But it may be what I was saying earlier about the lilt, or maybe the pronunciation of words in a slightly different way, or maybe distress, or maybe it wasn't a perfect RP structure that I was speaking. It was something that was more lilting, maybe. I can't remember so far back. But also, too, you see, when it became clear that any of us black students were going to be, if we didn't have this RP thing by the end of our first year, we're going to be channeled down certain paths in terms of what roles we could play. It was perfectly clear, looking at the students above me, that I had no intention, having come all that way, to be given servants' roles and to be made to feel that I couldn't tackle anything. I'd come all that way to do Shakespeare, and I was damned if I was going to be given any little this and that and t'other. And that was part of the thing that drove the idea about getting rid of your accent, was the notion then in the mid-60s that Shakespeare was spoken with perfect RP. The whole notion of regional Shakespeare was a little way not yet common. So poor Tom from Scotland still had to get this RP thing as well. And I thought, I haven't come all this way, with my love of English literature and my love of the romantic poets and all of that, to be denied what I had all gone to college for, which was to be able to speak all these great pieces of text. I hadn't come there to do anything else but to speak great pieces of text. I had told my father that I was going to a teacher training college, by the way, not anything to do with acting. He didn't know about the acting bit, never knew about the acting bit. In my time in Rose Bruford, I played Shakespeare. I had the misfortune to be in a production of Pride and Prejudice, where I played Fitzwarren, was it? Fitz somebody. And the makeup department at Rose Bruford tried to turn my skin white because they thought that it was not possible for a black person to be playing Jane Austen. That was the first time I met that thing, really. Any other kinds of inhibitions that black people might have had about being in an English training school like that in the depths of Kent weren't as obvious as trying to change the color of your skin. But I rode through that. It was an obstacle, but I rode through that. On the other side, of course, we were taught verse by Rose Bruford herself, by Greta Stevens. I was already in love with Keats. When I came to my to speak Keats, I was in my heaven, really. And I got good parts and got through to my third year. And it was very clear to me by then that opportunities for black actors were not great. I began to worry how I would work because I did want to be an actor after all. I'd come through all my life thinking I would be an actor. I had one audition for A Taste of Honey before I left college, and I didn't get the role. As it turned out, it was in the Library Theatre in Manchester. And then I was offered a job back at college. Then I think it was quite regular to take a graduate student as an assistant master tutor. And it was me that year. And I thought, yes, I will take this job. And so I then went back to Resbrugge to teach. It wasn't always the greatest thing, really. I mean, I graduated with a distinction in acting and in teaching. I felt qualified to teach. I should have really, if I were in the real world, I'd have done my probationary year and become a qualified teacher properly. But I didn't have any intention to do that. I wanted to be an actor. I was sidestepped into teaching in a way, but I enjoyed teaching very much. I loved teaching. And I think I had a vocation for teaching. What I was doing in the teaching time at Resbrugge was more or less regurgitating what I'd been taught. You know, I was given Mona Swan's rhythmic movement class, for example, and I really repeated what I had learned from her. She gave me all her musical instruments. I inherited her musical instruments, waves, lap, lap, fish fins, flap, flap, you remember all of that. I had Bernie Goss, I had teaching method, Bernie Goss's teaching method for the first year. I was given that, and I literally repeated much of what I'd learned from Bernie Goss, except that I had my own teaching notes to call upon. And I was an assistant to Dare Tucker in the dance, in the ballet. I was an assistant to Greta Stevens in the mime class. And when Percy Stephen arrived to take over the acting elements of the course, I often was his assistant as well. So I learned a lot from being part of those kinds of support structures. I occasionally had my own voice class, but I learned a lot from those previous people. And all of those people, Rose, Greta, Mona, all of them had much to teach us, I feel. And I learned a lot. Also, too, we were at college in a time of great, great theatrical, extraordinary things happening in the theater. You know, at the RSC with Peter Brook, World Theater Seasons, an extraordinary time to be a student, I think, and to be a student of theater, the National Theater at the Old Vic. And I absorbed a lot of that, I think, even as my teaching, during my teaching time. I left in order to go into the real world at last. And still there were no great acting opportunities. And so I freelanced as a tutor in several drama schools in London, which is where I formed my own notions of how students should be taught and how students should be trained. And I had this terrible kind of freelance life, which was, you know, I'd go to East 15 in Essex for morning and then come back on the tube to Webber Douglas for the afternoon. And so all of that, my life was just such a toing and froing. I had a great advocate, though, with Rue, who still continued to be in touch with me and to try and get me work. It was extraordinary. She worked so much, so hard for me, I think. I don't know what she was doing for other students, but she would always be trying to put work my way. And she had wanted me, I think, to take over some of Bernie Goss's children's theatre work, which never did happen. And by 1979, this would be 73, our first daughter arrived, Catherine, and it was becoming increasingly hard for me to live in London, I think, and to rear a child. And so I began to look outside of London. I came to Manchester in 77 to teach in the university. I had no degree. I was not one of them who had gone to Kent to convert their diploma into degrees. I had not wanted to be any kind of academic, I have to say. I wanted to be a working actor and a teacher. And I just didn't want to be an academic. But I went to Manchester University as a special lecturer in drama, they called it then. And it was open to anybody coming out of experience of the profession or teaching in the profession, if you like. So all my years in London drama schools were fitting me for this special role. I had a good time at Manchester. I was there for 4 years, and I had to be one step ahead of my students. I had a first year tutor group, for example, and I had to be one step ahead in terms of my reading and to make sure I could conduct those seminars well. But also I had to learn how to deal with essays, academic essays. I had to learn that from scratch, really. I had one lecture a year, a term rather. I had one lecture a term. I began, because it was a practical element of the teaching at the time, I began to introduce practical work, like I would run a mime class, for example, and then I'd run a voice class. And then I developed an Oriental theatre strand in which I would bring in practitioners from around the city. For example, I'd bring in an Indian dancer who would demonstrate dance as a theatrical form, because in some of those Eastern cultures, there is no definition between the spoken and the sung and the danced. And so I introduced that as a part of the course. By the time I was beginning to think of leaving, of course, all that freedom of expression in the drama department, which had a wonderful tradition going right back to Hugh Hunt, who started the drama department, who used to parade down the corridors in a flying cloak and hat, and was a wonderful, wonderful, extraordinary human being. And many universities at that time were thinking of having theatre studies departments. After 4 years, it seemed to me to be time. Time. I had never worked as an actor professionally. All the acting I had done since I left Rose Bruford was as an amateur with the Questors in Ealing. And there was where I kept going, still finding ways to work. I did a lot of acting in the university, all those avant-garde things, because this is the time of Grotowski, and everybody was getting all of that stuff out. And there was I, as a grown person, doing all this student-y stuff. You know, we did something called In the Penal Settlement, in which I was physically so at the mercy of this third year student. You know, God, looking back now, Ben Elton was a student in the English department, but always did work in the drama department. He began to write plays then. I took part in one of his plays called Death. I was Death in this play. So I was still acting all the way through this time, but no professional work. And in 1981, I thought the time had come. I was 41. I left the university. By then, we had two children. I left a very cushy number with what I was earning in the department to become an actor. 1981, I went to Leeds Theatre and Education Company. I was reminded then, of course, that all of Rose's work had come out of that teaching and acting strand. She wanted actors who could teach and teachers who could act. In 1981, I finally became that person. After all those years of study and of doing other things, I became a Rose Bruford graduate. I went to Leeds to be an actor teacher. It was wonderful, wonderful, because all my teaching, of course, fed straight into that. All my acting, too, fed straight into that. It was a salutary lesson to me to be in a theatre and education company in Leeds. This is a time when I think I finally became aware. I don't know how to put it, because I wasn't a militant person, but I was also thinking that through this period, I had forgotten how black I am and where I had come from. And one of the tutors in the university, we were talking about something to do with black people, and he said, "But Wiley, we never think about you as black." And it was like a bombshell had hit me suddenly. I thought, all this time, have I not been aware that I have been black? Or do I, my accent is now so far removed from what it was that I now am no longer black? It was such a shock to me. That's when I decided to leave the university, and I went to Leeds. We had a company of one Asian woman and me, two black people. And this, every day of our lives, we had racism. Every day of our working life. Every school we went into in Leeds, because we were working predominantly in poor white neighborhoods, we would go in and instantly our faces were seen. Children would do all of this stuff. Boys would lean out of the school window in the upstairs and give us Nazi salute. It was horrendous. And you would see racist graffiti all over the school, and you would say to the headmaster, do you know that there is all this racist? Oh, yes, we cleaned it up before, but it's always there. It was an appalling thing. I would go into some bits of Leeds, into Armley, for example, or Pudsey, and people would stare at me. All through the 3 years I was there, we learned how to deal with that racist thing. Because our plays were about imperialism, my play was about differences. You know, we had a play called Dirty Rascals, for example, which was for primary school children, in which Annalyn, the Asian woman, and me and the white boy would play together, and we would have conflicts within that because of who we were, but they had to be resolved somehow or other for these children. We did a play called Raj, in which I played an Indian man, and I had been reluctant to play any race other than my own race for a long, long time. Except that I knew we had this Indian strain in our family. And so I wrote to my dad and I said, I'm about to do a play with this company in which I have to play an Indian man. What can you tell me about our own history? And he told me then. And then I knew that I had Indian blood in me. And so I was happily put on the Indian garment and happily go into this play because I knew, yes, these are my roots as well. Raj was a very successful piece of work. A lot of TIA companies did it after we did it. But that we had, you know, we did a play about flags and bandages about the Crimean War. I can't think now. We did one about the canals in Yorkshire, the long canals that go from Liverpool through across the Pennines. We did one about that set in India about a tiger. We did extraordinary pieces of work, but we went into schools like real TI companies did, having prepared first. There was always a pre-time when we worked with the teachers. Then we did our play, and then there was a post-time. I love the work, apart from the racist thing. You had to learn not to blame the children for that and not to take it out on them. But they were great. You know, they would... The youngies particularly would always want to sit on your lap and hug you and all of that stuff. The older children were more difficult to cope with in the senior schools. But this was a great time. This is where I became a political person, not with a great big P, but with a little P. I suddenly became aware of the fact that I was a black person working within an industry that wasn't always going to be like I thought it should be. And that's how I developed my whole ethos thereafter, came from those 3 years. After that, I became an actor in the commercial world. I started at the Young Vic in Macbeth, playing Ross. And then I worked consistently for 10 years or so, till 1991. Always conscious of the fact that I wanted to be an actor first, black actor second. And never to do any work that in any way compromised who I was in any form. And also to be thinking that, yes, I can do that. I read a wonderful book early in my career called Staying Power, which tracked Africans in England from the time of the Romans right through history. And so anybody who said, oh, but you can't do that part, I'd say I was there. Oh, you can't. Oh, I was there. I always drew the line, though, at colorblind casting, which I think is a nonsense. Colorblind casting ignores really what the play is about. And to bung a black person into a play in which there is going to be conflict because of the very nature of that person being in the play means that the audience is constantly being distracted by that. If there is any reason why that part cannot be played by a black person, then they should play it. If there's a reason psychologically or philosophically or sociologically in which that is problematic, then you're asking for trouble because the play is going to be skewed in some way that the playwright never intended. And I don't think you should then tamper with the play in that way. I have no objection to all black productions, though I don't care for them myself. I've only been in one. Because I think that is giving in. You know, there was a notion here in England, for example, at the time that black people could only play Shakespeare if you put them all together and set the play in the Caribbean. You know, the National Theatre did that. You know, that was one way to say, oh, that's one way to get black people in, is to is to put them all together. Then they can do what they like with their speech. You know, I was told very early in my acting career that, you know, black people can't speak Shakespeare. I developed a one-person show later in my life about Ira Aldridge, who was the black American actor in the 19th century, who was constantly told every day of his working life that his mouth was too big, his lips were too big, that he can't speak Shakespeare, he can't pronounce Shakespeare. And how dare you, coming from Africa anyway, trying to speak Shakespeare, our national poet, all of that. And I think there is still some of that in the English theatre, even now, even though black actors now appear in everything across all the disciplines. But when I started in 1980, early 90s, late 80s, I was trying to be the best actor I could be in the best work I could find. You know, and if that meant playing this or that, then I would try to make it work for myself. I did meet occasionally the racist comment. When I played Antony and Mark Antony, a critic said, we are supposed not to notice that Antony is being played by a black man and being opposite a white woman, just in order to make sure that the local authority ticks his boxes about racial. Can you imagine this in 1980, whatever it was? And I also found sometimes that you had to work really hard to make sure people knew, especially in television, to make people sure people knew who you were. So because I had this middle class accent and I didn't speak Jamaican on the telephone, so if somebody phoned me up to offer me work and I spoke to them, I would turn up and then there'd be a little moment of shock when they found out I'm black. Ah, and I didn't have that kind of street chat, so I couldn't walk in and start to do all of that thing, you know, which is what the stereotypic televisual person wants. You know, to do all of that, and I'm not that kind of person. In the end, they do recognize this, and then they stop giving you that kind of foolish comment, really. I stopped doing television because early in my acting life, I played in The Bill, and I played a Jamaican man whose son was in trouble with the police for pushing drugs. Some many, many years later, I went back to The Bill to audition, this time for a grandfather whose grandson was in trouble with the police for pushing drugs. And I came out of that and I phoned my agent and I said, stop, please stop it. I'm not doing any more of this. This is nonsense. Every time I do television, I'm compromised by the fact that I have to enter this medium, which I think does not value us as people and does not value actors in any way. And so I stopped it. But that's only my own personal way of operating in the world. And that's where the small p comes in, really. 1991, I went to the Arden School, new school starting up in collaboration with the Royal Exchange Theatre in Manchester to become the first head of acting there. It was crucial to me to do this at the time I did it, 1991, because by then, I had a very clear idea of how I think actors should be trained and what I think the theatre should offer them, and that they should be trained in a way to make the theatre, not the other way around, not to make train them for a theatre that was already in existence, which is how London drama schools operated, really. They turned out these people on this treadmill to fit this theatre that was there, which meant that people like me probably would be excluded from that theatre. And I wanted a school, I wanted an acting course that was open to anybody, that was open to women, particularly of a certain age, because there was a time in school drama school training here when after 26, you just couldn't get in. You were too old. The oldest student we ever took was 62. And she had lived her life. She'd been in the army. She'd raised her children. She'd always wanted to be an actor. And at 62, she said, now is my time. And she did. She graduated at 65. I wanted there to be a strong representation for black people. You know, a lot of black people didn't get into drama schools because they couldn't speak properly to the schools. I wanted women of a certain age, as I said, because so many women didn't want to go to London. Couldn't afford to go to London, had families here to tend, had partners here to keep their family lives. And so the school opened its doors to all and sundry. And I wanted also a whole kind of different way of training to make it more organic, to make us relate to the world we were in, not to give us a kind of special, you know, this is the theatre we're training for. I've always been conscious that the English repertoire is so anti anything other than the English kind of actor. So how can you fit into a repertoire which is constantly going backwards, looking at the past, and only constructing work that fits the past? So all the graduates that came out of Arden were people who I didn't mind if they never acted in their lives after that. I knew they should be thinking, this is for my life. I will always be acting for my life, not for this till fame and fortune hits me or not. And many of them went into theatre, and some of them are quite famous now, but a lot of them didn't go into theatre. They become something else. When I meet them now, they'll say, I've never forgotten that training, but now I'm doing this, do you know? And I wanted them to make a difference in the world. I wanted them to go out there and say, yes, we spent 3 years with Wiley Longmore, and this is who we are. Yes! And I think that worked for a long time. When we tried to become a member of the Conference of Drama Schools, we applied, I think, in our second year, maybe, of the school, or maybe even later than that. We were viewed by some people who came up from London and patronized us dreadfully and told us, by then we were a university department because we had to survive. And the only way to survive was to become a degree course, which we did, validated by Manchester University, of course. And these people came up from London and patronized us dreadfully for a whole day and then told us, no, they wouldn't recommend we become a member of the Conference of Drama Schools because we were just a glorified liberal arts course. Oh, that cuts so deeply, you know, to be dismissed and dismissed as a liberal arts course. Now, what's wrong with a liberal arts course, you want to ask yourself in the first place, but no, you misunderstand what this is all about here. And you come with your glorified London airs to tell me I should be training students. It didn't sit well with me, really. But we had got our validation from the university by then, and there we were turning out students who were BAs in acting studies, which was great. We were within an FE college, which meant that our life was hard, because we became a part of that college because they were beginning to think about their own kind of offer. So they were developing more and more higher ed courses, BTEC higher ed courses, and they were beginning to go towards university degree courses, and we were one of the first. But we didn't sit well within the FE context because we worked every day of the week, every hour of that working day, and there was none of this, you know, 20 students in a room, 30 students in a room. They would come around and there would be three people in the room and they'd say, why are there only three people in this room? And I'd say, because they're doing a play. And this is a scene that requires three people. The pressure was quite great to keep this notion. Why don't you take more students? Why don't you take more students? Why don't you take more students? I think the college was waiting for me to go, really. I think I was beginning to get, life was hard. They took over another college in the city centre. And I decided then to leave 11 and a half years of my life. I continued to work periodically through that period, but I thought you can't be all things to all people. You have to be focused. But I was mindful of the fact that I didn't ever want to become one of those teachers who said, I used to act in front of a group of students. Never. I would be working, and I remember once I was in a play in a studio, My Children, My Africa, and I start the play and the lights go up and the whole front row are my students sitting there looking at me. And I thought, you could at least have sat somewhere else, you know, not in the front row. But it meant the next morning I could talk to them about what had happened to me that night. And it felt to me that that's what all the tutors in the school are, people who had live experience still of working, not people who had retired and would come and visit themselves upon poor students who couldn't defend themselves. And to me, it was important. If I'm talking about how do you make a living, how do you make this work for you, what are your tasks here? What are your choices here as an actor? How do you create your work with this scene? How do you begin to address the needs of this playwright? How do you relate to the other people who are on the stage with you? It had to come out of my own experience of doing that. It can't come from anything else. It can't come from some theory of how you do it. It must come from your practice. And so always to me, I needed to be on the stage myself and to be faced with the difficulties of what it means to be working. After 11 and a half years, I thought, I could see the course was changing. They wanted to scrap one of a year. We would do 3 years to become a BA in an ordinary degree, and we had a fourth year which gave us an honours. It was a wonderful structure because it meant that fourth year for those students was rich. They had a whole year in which to focus on what it meant to become a theatre maker of whichever kind they like. I liked that idea very much. So that, you know, the dissertation was coming out of their practice, not out of some kind of stuff that comes out of their heads. But I could see the college thought that was expensive. Part-timers cost too much money. They wanted everybody to go onto contracts so they can control how they paid them. I could see all the signs and thought, well, it go now. We moved into the new school, the new buildings in the town. I left before that happened. And I went back to the theater to become an actor and to become a director. And I'd never worked so much in my life because I was coming back. Oh, Wiley's back. My agent would say, oh, they think that you've stopped acting. I said, no, I only temporarily left for 11 and a half years to run a course. But I'm back now. Oh, right, fine. We don't know whether Wiley wants to do this, but it was great. I had a lovely, lovely, lovely time. And all of that work really was fulfilling in a lot of ways. I played some really good work, but I also directed more and I continued to teach. I taught for several seasons at the Welsh College. I taught at Manchester Metropolitan. And I also began more and more to teach, to do one-to-one tutoring. Particularly as years went by, I didn't ever acknowledge the school after the years I left there because it was such a different school and such a different course. It had nothing to do with me. And I would get from my 11 and a half years, students would return to me to ask, what can I do now? Where shall I go? And I'd sit down, we'd have coffee, and or they'd dropped out and had become parents and now we're wanting to come back. And what shall I do? I want to continue. And I would help them. I always helped them. My last real acting work was at the Royal Exchange in 2010, was The Back Eye. I began increasingly to become really sort of bored with acting, you know, because the older you get, the more people assume you know everything. And so you would be in a company and you would be left severely alone. You would say, you know, have you any notes for me? Oh, Wiley, you don't need notes. You know, you can. Oh. And you just sat there for 4 weeks. Young actors can talk to you about nothing other than their television work, what they've done and what they're doing next. Occasionally a real old stager will be there with you and you are not the oldest person anymore in the company and you can talk about life and art and living and the state of the world. And, you know, young actors have no political viewpoint. I don't mean party viewpoint, no political viewpoint about the place that they hold in the world in terms of what their acting experience is for and about. You know, it's about fame, fortune, money. Yes, all those things. I have no problem with any of that. But also we have such a gift to get onto that space, open up the world for the people who watch and make something live happen. You know, that's what acting is about. And so I got very bored and I started to think, oh, go and find something else to do. And so I started to sit on other people's boards. In 1991, I joined the board at Contact Theatre. And in 1997, I took over the chair. So I became chair of Contact Theatre from 1997 to 2007, 10 years. In that time, Contact became a theatre for young people. From a quasi-rep, which it had been, doing what it called work for young people, but really it was about schools, you know. We were doing the usual rep fair. And during that period that I took over the chair, we went into a kind of revisioning period. We were building a new bit to the theatre, and we needed to change. And we became a young people's theatre at last. Young people became the heart of the organisation. It became a participatory building. People would flock in. Before that, we were bang in the middle of Hume and Moss Side, and yet very few black people came to the theatre. When that revisioning happened and reopened in 1997, the place was flooded by young people who finally came into a space they could call their own. Took 10 years of my life, that did. Then I joined the board at the Royal Exchange Theatre, and then I joined the board at the New Arts Centre called Home. So a lot of my energy was going in those directions, more directing it in the theatre, no acting, less and less acting. And then I developed my Irish show, which kept me acting. And then I got ill in 2014 and everything stopped. So all of last year, I was, after chemotherapy, I was in a state of somewhere else, really. My brain was somewhere else. I was not the same person. In a way, even though I wouldn't say I had wished illness on myself, it was a way to stop, to reevaluate where I was, to find out whether what I was doing was really what I wanted to do with my life, or whether I should be thinking that I should be moving on to something else. Even at the great age I am of 75, was I just literally just responding to need, as you do? People ask you for help and you give it. But is that really what you want? Are you just not running on a kind of treadmill? So I stopped work, really. And all last year, my brain was somewhere else anyway. This year, I began to feel I was closer to myself because I began to get really angry about what's going on in theatre now. And I would be in a performance. I would be in the theatre, in the audience, and I would be seething with anger at what was going on the stage. And I was so close to getting up and standing up in the midst of the audience saying, stop this, stop it. What do you think you're doing? What do you think you're doing? And Estelle would be stroking my arm, saying, calm down, calm down, calm down. So I knew I was getting back to myself. And so now I'm just gradually beginning to think about work again and how to work. I'm working with a group of refugees at the moment, for example, creating kind of pop-up theatre. I sit on two boards of two small organisations. I chair one and I'm on the board of another. Last week, you won't know this, I don't think, Paul. Last week, I became a fellow of the Rose Bruford College, which brings the story up to date. I was trying to remember the kinds of words I would have had at my disposal as a child, as growing up through that period, not just the period of 8 years when I was in the country. And there were several of them that really, and some I still use now. For example, I still use jing bang, which means good for nothing, which can also mean a group of people. I still say to Estelle, what a lot of jing bang. What a lot of jing bang out there. Or I'll say, when my sisters and I meet, we go back into patois and I'll say, you know, kuya, look here, kuya, kuya. Or my sister will say, well, you think you're a talk boat? Well, you think you're a talk boat? Just because you're English, man, no, you think you can't talk like that. And we would just, because they live in America, and of course they are tinged with American, their own speech now. They hardly speak any patois. But I love some of these words we use as children. Fenki fenki. Fenki fenki means somewhat sort of precious, sort of puny and precious, you know. There's a lovely word called stortious, which means high class, you know. That person is acting so stortious. It's who she thinks she is. She's stortious, you know. And galang, go on, galang, no, or dutty. Dutty means ground or dirt, dirty. These words, Louise Bennett used to say that she found when she started out her career that people would say that Jamaican English or Jamaican speech was a corruption of the English language. And she said that because the English think that their language is derived from various sources, that Jamaican dialect, Jamaican language, is corrupt. And she would say, "We are derived as well." She would say in her own accent, "We derive. Jamaica derive." And it means that our language is based on very many influences, not least of all Africa, where most of our ancestors would come from. But I was remembering some of these words and also how we would vary the use of the patois. For example, somebody would say, "Away you are go. Away you are go. Where are you going? Away you are go." But you would also say, "Away you da go. Away you da go." Or, "Is where you going? Is where you going?" Those three mean exactly the same thing. Where are you going? Is where you going? Is where you are go? Where you are go? Do you know? Another word I use now is "cotch," you know, which is to sit. It means to sit in a small space. So you cotch yourself, you know. Don't cotch yourself, dear. Don't cotch yourself. We always love, my sisters and I, to see the market women going to market. Where we lived in Stirling in the country, my grandmother knew everybody. And she was called Mammy. And people would be coming on a journey and would call, "Mammy, Mammy, you're there? You're there? Are you at home? You're there?" And she would come out and she would had made journey cakes, Johnny cakes, we call them, journey cakes. And they'd wrap the journey cakes up and these people would take these to eat on their journey. And so we always had that sense of the women with the bankra on their head, the baskets on their head. My sisters and I would get into these little games, these games we would play in which, you know, that we would take on these fancy things, you know. "This long time gal me never see you, make me hold your hand. Is a long time gal me never see you," and all that ring game. "Brown skin gal, stay home and mind your baby." This is a very famous one. Lots of those songs we sang were work songs, like "Some me dead, some me dead, some me dead, oh." Mm-hmm. "Some me dead, some me dead, some me dead, oh." Mm-hmm. Or my grandmother had a companion called Hazel who would break stones for the road, and she'd sit at our gate on an increasing pile of stones as the pile grew, which then people would come along and then distribute on the stone. They still do that with the railways. It's interesting. And you would get a song like "Bigodong a money well road, gallon boy, figure brook crack stone, gallon boy, broke them one by one, gallon boy, broke them two by two, gallon boy, member play with a play, gallon boy." The other thing we did too was to scare ourselves to death with ghost stories. They're an area of country of your land called the barbecue, which is not like an American or an English barbecue where you cook meat, but it would be where you would lay out coffee to dry. It would dry on the barbecue and you would lay it out and dry it and then you would shell it and then make coffee for yourself. Or this is where you would put pimento. You know, pimento is a spice on a tree, and it would be sold. So my grandmother would have a day when she'd pick her pimento and then would lay it out on the barbecue to dry. And then it would be collected by trucks who took it away. She did the same with her oranges, and she did the same with her coffee too. But my sisters and I and our friends would wait for a really dark night because there was no street lighting and so everything was dark. And we'd sit on the barbecue and frighten each other to death by telling each other stories. And we'd tell each other dopey stories. So a doppy is a ghost, of course. My grandmother had a real belief in the other world. She believed in obia, in voodoo. She believed that she had been blighted in her own life by obia. Her husband, pardon me, Nathaniel, was buried on our land. And she would go out to the barbecue and she'd say, "Natty Brown." Natty, short for Nathaniel. Natty Brown, her husband was Nathaniel Brown. And she said, "Natty Brown, you see what's happening to me? What you doing to help me?" My mother was very grievously ill once. And my grandmother went out and said, "You see your daughter?" My mother was called Miss Nat after her father, who was Nathaniel. And you say, "You see your daughter? What you are doing? What are you doing about your daughter? My mother recovered the next day. My grandmother had infinite belief in these things. So we would be speaking these bits of patwa for ourselves, even though when my dad was around, we didn't, because he didn't approve, because it meant being low class, working class, and only working class people spoke patwa. It was something that I thought we all should speak, really. It was part of our heritage to speak it. But another word, fiercy, rude, people fiercy. You're fiercy now? Older people would say to you, if you said, did any of that stuff to them, they'd say, fiercy boy, you're fiercy. Or you're fiercy gal, you're fiercy. Maka. Maka is a lovely, lovely word. We have certain plants in Jamaica that have very long thorns, very, very long thorns, about this long. And we used to, my sisters and I used to write notes on a particular plant that is a succulent using these long thorns. And we'd write messages to each other and leave in a hole in the wall. As my cousins came, who lived inland, more further inland than we did, they would come and they would find the messages in the wall, and we'd written with this maka, not with a pen. But maka. And if you really wanted to mock somebody, you would say, use what they would say, a thorn pierced me, or a thorn scratched me. They would say, maka juk me, maka juk me. So you would say, maka juk me na mihan. And we would do this always, often in a mockery of other people who spoke like that naturally, and we didn't, because we went to proper schools. But in the end, you began, by the time I was leaving Jamaica, the whole movement for independence was beginning. And so all such things as the Anansi stories, which we'd grown up with, Louise Bennett and the dialect poems that she wrote, other people were writing in dialect. By the time there was independence in 62, there was a groundswell of natural Jamaican history, Jamaican language, Jamaican culture, Jamaican art and craft in every manner of way, so that the Jamaican language became a celebration rather than something to look down on. And so now when my sisters and I meet, we joyously say, now we speak, we can talk patwa now, and nobody can stop us talking it, you know. And you and we can sit there and talk patwa with each other. But it's that stigma has gone, I think, now, you know. And you mentioned in your book about, you know, the a lot of the work that's been done to convert certain extant text into the patwa language. I find it sometimes difficult to read that, because it doesn't often feel like speech. It feels like language translated into some kind of literary form. But it can't, for example, sometimes have those little expressions in the idiom, like, you know, I don't know what you're talking about, you know. I don't know what you're talking about, you know. This woman I met the other day who said, I said, how are you doing, Gwen? She said, I'm feeling all right, you know. And she's lived here a long time, but she still uses that, you know, or you see. You know, that boy fiercy, you see, that boy fiercy, you know, that boy fiercy, all that. And darling in English, darling with the accent on the first syllable, darling. But in Jamaica, darling with no G. So you'll say, I'm feeling good today, darling. How are you doing yourself? Darling, do this for me, no? Or pick up a little bit of shopping for me, no? Or, you want, yeah, I feel so tired, I can't sit down here with you. We can sit down here with you for a little while. Come and rest me foot. Make I rest me foot. Make I rest myself. Johann Blake, the runner, who is Bolt's training partner. Johann Blake was here. Was it during the Olympics, when the Olympics were in London? And somebody asked him why he hadn't turned up for this early morning training. And Johann Blake, who actually trains in America, Johann Blake said, "Me foot cool." My feet were cold. "Me foot cool." And suddenly this whole Jamaican came back, you know, this wonderful muscular boy who trains in, you know, America and is such a good runner. "Me foot cool." There is the Jamaican boy still. I think partly that business about that celebration of a language that we felt was our language, but were forbidden to speak, or that language that we took delight in because it was so expressive, or that language that reminded us that so many of our expressions came from Africa, and therefore we felt that there was a link there, that we were celebrating that in ourselves. And then we would laugh, you know. Louise Bennett is fond of writing about barefoot boys, because most of us didn't wear shoes, of course. I grew up not wearing shoes. And not because we couldn't afford shoes, but that's the way we went about. But she talked about the barefoot boy. Or she would say that somebody had gone to America and came back talking like this, talking proper, talking, you know, like they'd never been to Jamaica at all. And there were some people, you hear it in one of your Jamaican recordings, where there is a tension between somebody who has spoken Patois before and has now learned not to speak it. And so you get this slightly tight kind of speech where they're trying desperately not to say the wrong word. And so you get this really slightly artificial way of speaking. We were very fond of laughing at people like that, who would say, you know, or drop the H, you know, and so you would say, and you would snigger because they dropped the H, but they were trying to talk proper. But because they were trying to talk proper, they had forgotten that, in fact, you have to put the H back, all of that. But that was a kind of way of growing up. You know, we stopped doing that when we became seen as school children, because so many of our companions were speaking Patois anyway by that time. And now it's perfectly acceptable to speak it. You know, it is the Jamaican language.